Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, creation science. Does such a thing still exist? And Ray Brown, he's a former NHS psychotherapist. He'll be talking about his views on psychotherapy. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square on 0117 989 7733. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Ray Brown. Hi, Ray, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, tell us about your past a little bit. How did you get into being a psychotherapist?
Well, I did anaesthetics for a while, which was putting people to sleep. And then I learned I preferred to speak with them. So I moved into psychiatry, working in London. And then through contacts there, became interested in psychotherapy. And over the years, I worked in a number of different settings in London, including therapeutic communities.
Now, before we get off the subject of anaesthetics, that's obviously something you know quite a bit. You're as an anaesthetist. How long were you doing that for?
For about 3 years.
And you found it was just not so engaging. I mean, obviously, if someone's asleep. But, I mean, how does that all work? Because one does wonder with anaesthetics, you know, do people somehow, you know, just simply not feel what's going on? And do sometimes people, even though there may be, they may maybe appear on the surface to be asleep, do they sometimes wake up halfway through an operation, that kind of thing?
Well, I became interested in psychiatry while doing anaesthetics. I saw people on surgical wards weeping, and perhaps they weren't talked to very carefully sometimes. And then I noticed I spent more time talking to people before they had surgery. And people come into surgery from all sorts of situations. They have trouble at home, they're worried about the operations and so on. And I found that people who were anxious and who had some conflict would have bad reactions to anaesthetics. Particularly, it was difficult to control their post-operative pain. And sometimes they developed breathing difficulties.
Oh, so it's interesting that some people would react reasonably well to anaesthetics and others differently, and there was a psychological element to that.
There was a psychological element.
That's fascinating. So what was that, did you discover?
Well, I think the whole process of an operation is very stressful, and when you have additional stresses on top of it, you know, the nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system goes into overdrive.
Okay, so let me stop you again there. Sorry, the sympathetic nervous system, what's that?
It's the thing that controls heart rate and blood pressure, pulse, and is linked with what's called a fight or flight response. So these people were very revved up and responded to sedative drugs differently.
Okay, but one would have thought if they're under, you know, say once they've been under anaesthetic, that would all go. But are you saying that there was still some kind of bad reaction if someone was nervous before they actually went under?
That's right, and it ran through into the post-operative period as well.
Fascinating.
And then there were a few psychiatrists about, and I started chatting with them, and they seemed to be reading interesting books. So I made a switch, and I've never regretted it. I mean, my experience has been personally very moving, very rewarding, and a great privilege, really.
Now, I know you've spent 2 to 3 decades in the National Health Service, and we're hearing now some of your personal recollections. But what decades were they?
Oh, from 1980, 1990, 2000, up until now.
Now, you've seen some very big changes in psychiatry and also in the way that people are treated or not treated, I would imagine, over that time. One thing I can remember from around about 1990, in the early 90s, it was called care in the community. Now, I know it might sound like a bit of a trite question, but did that work?
Well, I think there were concerns about long-term hospitalisation and the idea of the old mental asylum that was thought to distance people who needed help, and the care in the communities was, I think, pioneered with a very good idea of integration into the community so people could live in a normal environment. The difficulty about it, and perhaps we'll discuss this, is the beds closed in huge numbers, and perhaps care in the community wasn't really properly funded as it might have been. And there's still a, an ongoing debate as to whether there should be more community care or more beds.
Well, it sounds good, doesn't it, care in the community? And I can see that people were moved from large psychiatric hospitals out into the community, but I'm not so sure about the care side.
Well, care's a difficult word. It implies something. When people think of the word care, they think of being looked after, often in an emotional context or a family context. So care in the community might have some aspect of being a slogan for political purposes. In fact, it can be quite difficult to care for people in the community, because people's lives in the community aren't just the times they're in treatment, but the whole background context in which they exist, of having work or having enough to eat, of having safe housing and so on. And there are a whole range of things that are required to make care in the community really work. The other thing I think is important, I realize there's sometimes a sense of a compassionate hand on the shoulder can be more meaningful to people than any amounts of prepackaged delivery of care.
Now, some say that people who were put in the community in that situation, maybe to begin with they were given a little bit of help, but then they were kind of almost left on their own to fend for themselves in the community, rather than, it's almost like fend for yourself in the community rather than care in the community. And of course many of these people have got some quite serious needs.
Yes, I mean we see slogans in a variety of settings, like big society and so on, and care in the community did have this aspect of being a slogan. It's one thing to produce a slogan, it's quite another thing to deliver on the ground. And sometimes to assess the impact of anything in psychiatry is quite difficult. A man called Tom Burns wrote a book called Unnecessary Shadow in relation to psychiatry. It points out that psychiatry is really a complex field with many different aspects, many different professionals, many different perspectives. And what tended to happen, I think, is that where data was collected, often it was quantitative and didn't really look at the question of quality. One very good example of this is a program for high expressed emotion in relation to mitigating against people who suffer from a schizophrenic illness breaking down. In fact, what was done is the family was worked with to reduce the level of emotionality in the family. But the flip side of that was that then the individual experienced themselves in a slightly cold and distant environment, even though they didn't break down.
It's a very difficult one, isn't it? The whole thing of mental illness. Is there any actual definition of mental illness, or some? Can you define whether someone is or isn't mentally ill?
Well, this is a contentious thing. There are books that have lists of definitions, like DSM-5 and ICD-10. These are manualized books developed for operational purposes, really for research purposes. Then there's the political aspect of who defines what a mental illness is. My own preferred view is I prefer to hear what distress people feel they're suffering in their own words, and work with that. Sometimes, of course, it may be necessary to consider other things if they're having very grave problems. But I think that people have the right to describe how they feel and make judgments on it. Certainly, that is one view that is taken within certain sections of psychiatry.
Now, a few years ago, I'm thinking about roughly 1999, I was involved in a little a land occupation over in Norwich of a former mental hospital there. We hit the headlines over several weeks because we were occupying it really to show it was an important piece of public land, and we didn't want it to be, and neither did the local people, sold off for housing. It was just a simple issue. But because we'd hit the headlines, we had, over those 2 weeks, a lot of people actually came and visited us on site who had used the mental hospital over the years. And I got a very different view than I ever had before about mental health institutions, because every single person that came to see us told us about how much they valued their time there and how much it had helped them get over whatever the problem had been, whether it was to do with being bankrupt, losing their job, their home, this kind of thing, whether it was family or whether it was in any way related. And every single person that came to visit us on that site said that institution was in some way a bit of a lifesaver. Now, is that just a one-off experience, do you think, or do you think there's some truth to the fact that we've been sold a bit of a myth about big institutions from the past, that actually some of them were great places to be and very caring?
Yes, I mean, my own experience in relation to this is, you may know that Barrow Gurney Hospital in Ashton has closed down. That was a hospital with large grounds and not very much in good upkeep. But from speaking about people who were inpatients there, many people have told me that what they appreciated was the experience of the space of the grounds, the trees, of being in contact with nature, of having some separation from the hustle and bustle of things. Certainly there was no sense of claustrophobia there. And they made a connection that was meaningful to that place. And I'm quite surprised by that, really. It's a collateral benefit. The other place that I think was really quite remarkable was the Castle Hospital in Richmond, which was a therapeutic community. That never seemed like a hospital at all. And the connection that people made to that environment was very meaningful. And individual wards, like Ward 6 in the Maudsley, where someone called Murray Jackson, who's now dead, tried to run a ward combining aspects of psychiatry and psychotherapy together. So on that ward, there'd be large groups and small groups. Every patient would have individual therapy twice a week, and it combined both psychotherapeutic approaches as well as medication. And the people who went through that made very deep connections with the place. So there are factors that can make people feel held and cared, and this definitely helps to recover. Because if there's a negative reaction to an environment, even, you know, buildings like sick building syndrome, this does impact on people's health. The morale of the staff, of course, is very important in this, and where the staff morale is undermined, as it is by all these changes currently, then it's just a bit harder for them, working in a fragmented system, to summon from within themselves the human resources to feel and engage with people in meaningful ways. But in the places I mentioned, I think that did happen. Yeah.
What's the difference between psychology and psychotherapy then?
Well, I think most people find the distinction very difficult, and there is a general confusion between psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. In broad terms, psychiatrists are medically qualified, and they can prescribe psychotropic medication. That was the case in the past, and they still do now. But that's prescribing, right, is generalized now to nurses and some psychologists too. Psychologists do a degree in psychology and then study clinically, and they're much more focused on a wide variety of things. But one thing that is relevant in the National Health Service is the provision of psychotherapies, and there are different kinds of psychotherapies. One sort that everyone's heard of is cognitive behavioral therapy. And another sort is psychodynamic, as well as group therapy.
Can you just take us through those types of therapy? Because they're now, I mean, to you, obviously, they're something quite normal. But just take us through those different types of therapy so that we can just get our heads around the sort of things that you're prescribing for people and others in your world.
Yes. Well, one very important issue is a distinction between what is called an ideographic approach. An ideographic approach, it means, it's rather like a holistic approach, is considering an individual's total life and total life story. A normothetic approach is where you look at populations generally. So, for example, within the population, there'd be so many people who might have been diagnosed suffering from depression by their general practitioner. So there are some therapies that are addressed directly to symptoms of an illness. Now, the trouble with therapies is often they focus on the question of symptoms, but they don't often focus on the person's life story and the developments in health that can occur with therapy. Now, I feel personally that art therapy is one therapy that I've liked a lot, and I've worked closely with art therapists, that really does something, bring out something creative in people. It's not just about illness. You say in any illness there's always considerable health and well-being, even in individuals who seem not to be very healthy at all. So art therapists have worked with people over many, many years and helped them develop. My own speciality, which is psychodynamic psychotherapy, really is a process of an individual talking about their whole life from early childhood through to adulthood. And we try to work out where the pitfalls have been. And there can be pitfalls in people's lives that lead them repeatedly back into issues of that are likely to cause them psychological distress.
What about religion, though? Because back in years gone by, it would probably have been the jobs of priests to deal with people who had mental illness problems, what we would call now today mental illness. Is there any kind of crossover between the two, between, you know, kind of the old idea of what was, I suppose, a spiritual illness and now is looked at as mental illness?
Yes, I would completely agree. I mean, there are groups within, certainly, the Royal College of Psychiatry that look at spiritual matters, and there are religious people within that group, and that one facet of illness, you know, in the musical West Side Story, Officer Cuffsby refers to a social disease, you know, that the kids have a social disease. They're not really bad, they have a social disease. And I think that there's a possibility that a lot of difficulty we are experiencing may be results of the culture we're exposed to. That in preparing for this program, I tried to look around the world and say, where are the healthiest people? It's a very difficult question to answer. But there are some communities and social organizations, including where religion is an element. I'm not personally religious myself. And this is very sustaining for them. In the attempts to help in the Middle East in relation to children that have been traumatized by bombing, it was found that one successful intervention was psychosocial therapy, where they really attempted to rebuild social networks. And this is something that we really haven't looked at in the West very much. Each case is taken on its own, and not enough consideration is thought in building the social networks that we might need to keep us healthy.
Is it fair to say that psychiatry is a kind of secular version of what in the old days would have been pastoral care by bishops, priests and these kind of people?
I think there's always an element of that, just as there is in the question of placebo. You know, placebo responses are very powerful. People get better and from certain symptoms.
Why does that? I mean, I've always wanted to ask a psychiatrist this. Why does that work? I mean, what you're doing is you're taking a pill which has got no active ingredient in it, and yet it seems to help cure you.
Well, I think that magic is a pretty important part of our cultural heritage. If you there's a book called Magic in England. Now, I'm not advocating a belief in magic, but magic can have a social power, even though, you know, frogs don't turn into princes or lead into gold. It has a definite meaning within society as
it's
a social
change.
It's
kind of mind over matter.
Yes, that's right, and that can be very powerful. For example, it can be so powerful, the mind over matter, you may not know this, but when people are hypnotized, if you say that you're going to touch their hand with something hot, in certain cases they actually develop blisters. So when a pill is delivered with the right authority, I don't do this myself, that the psychological effect, the belief, if you want, can actually.
But what about the ethics of that, though, Ray? Because I mean, what you're doing basically is conning your patient.
Yes, I would agree. That's why I said I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yes, but the thing is, there are all sorts of ethical problems there. But at the end of the day, if it works, if it helps to cure the person, then, you know, there must be some, at least, argument for it to be an ethical thing to do.
Well, I would agree. I mean, people's opinions matter very much on this. And I think that there is some awareness that there may be a placebo
okay. thing. Also, one of the things that I must bring up is the constant calls by the police to say that something needs to be done in society about the way that we deal with mental health, because the police time and time again is saying that there's mental health elements to so much of what the police are being called to deal with. And also, people that used to be maybe cared for, looked after in mental health institutions are now filling our prisons. This is the police talking, not me.
Well, it's true. I'm very grateful to you inviting me to speak on this programme, because one of the things I've read up about is austerity. And I've read, you know, the Mark Blyth's book, Austerity, the history of a dangerous idea. And looked into the police actions in relation to 136. There's a very good...
What do you mean by 136? You better explain that, I think.
This is a section that can be used by the police to detain someone in a place of safety.
Okay, this is a Mental Health Act, I'm guessing?
It's a Mental Health Act, under the 1983
okay.
Mental Health Act.
Right.
Now, the paper by the Independent Police Complaints Commission was written in 2006, and it looked at factors around the country. One... fact that has really staggered me was the section is only meant to be used exceptionally, but in 2006 11,900 people were detained by the police, but there were only 590,000 people in hospital for the same reasons, place of safety. In other words, there were twice as many people in police cells as there were in hospitals. And there was a difference, really, in how police forces functioned in relation to use of 136. Bristol is a high area of usage, with about currently, or in 2006, 144 sections of 136.
Can you give us an idea of the sort of incident that might persuade the police to use this section 136?
Well, in the paper I've mentioned, there are very good examples of how difficult the police find the judgment to make. It's particularly difficult if there's a case of drug use or intoxication. One policeman quoted in this paper said that if you see someone, you know, wandering naked on a railway track and in an unsafe situation, you can probably say that they're suffering from some sort of distress. That is more clear-cut. But in other cases, it can be difficult to decide. So what some police forces have done is stuck guidelines in their stations so they can run through the various criteria that helps them make a decision. But is a mistake possible? Yes, a mistake is possible, as with any human judgment. The astonishing thing is that no one really amongst the psychiatric population, the mental health population, has raised forcefully enough that people have been detained in police stations. And this difficulty, I think, results from the fact that when, from my experience, when doctors hear about a new change, they immediately become very concerned about how on earth they're going to deal with it and work with it, rather than actually oppose it. And I've seen a number of health changes come in where the staff have been forced to accommodate to them, even though they disbelieved in their underlying principles. So in 2006, this document raised the idea that it was unacceptable to put patients in distress, people in distress, in cells. Nothing's been done until now, rather strangely, by a coalition government, which is slightly paradoxical in relation to the damage that the austerity measures are
causing. Well, can I ask you, pull on your therapist side here for a minute and say, if you were prescribing for the government a way to deal with this, what would you be prescribing them, assuming that they would listen?
Well, there's an article in the British Medical Journal in July this year called The Burden of Austerity. and it's responses really from a survey of GPs. They start off with the fact that people in the lower fifth of the income distribution are now amongst the most deprived in Western Europe.
That's the bottom 20% income.
Yes, 20% of people. So a huge number. Staggeringly large number of people. And they highlight in this paper that the Labour government introduced changes moving over to the idea of employment support allowance from the old incapacity benefit. But this was made even more difficult in 2012 by this coalition government, who introduced work capacity assessment. Now, what the GPs say in relation to that this has caused incredible harm because it's meant a huge number of people have lost their benefits, and that the impact of this has actually damaged people's health. In the survey, 77% of GPs say that these changes have damaged their patients' health. That's in inner city. In towns, it's 70%. So it's a very large number indeed. And this is the direct consequence of increased poverty and increased insecurity, including in cases where people have lost their benefit, which they now can do if there's any difficulties in not finding work within 1 year. They're left, as far as I can understand, you may know about this, destitute.
Well,
and
there have
been
right.
suicides in relation to them.
Well, one of the big problems with this, of course, is a potential employer is much less likely to employ these people. So it's almost as if they're being asked to do an almost impossible task. Now, that's bound to affect people's mental health.
Yes, absolutely. Mental health and
in fact, they're not being asked, they're being told, aren't they? Instructed.
Yes, yes.
You will get yourself a job, even though there are a million 18 to 25 year olds who are perfectly mentally healthy competing with you for those jobs. So what they're in is almost like a sort of wrestle for the job, which ultimately, almost certainly, they're going to lose. But then they're being blamed for that, which just sounds, you know, like some kind of mental torture. But I'll come back to the original question. What would you prescribe as some sort of remedy to this?
To what, sorry, Tony? To
the damage that's being caused by austerity.
Well, I think the government aren't going to take action on it. Certainly, Mark Blyth says it's a very carefully camouflaged movement of money from the poorest to the richest in order to deal with the banking crisis. So it's one example of a policy that increases disparity.
Okay, but again, I'm going to do Jeremy Paxman on you here. What should they do? Don't worry about if they, you don't think they would or not, but what should they be doing?
They should stop spending money on armaments and fighting wars and shift it immediately to health, social care, housing and schools. Absolutely, without a doubt. The view that I've formed is that the policy isn't going to work anyway, because you have the difficulty of every country at the same time trying to recover their deficit, which means that there's zero growth, i.e. there's nowhere to sell to and nowhere to produce. And some observers have noticed this.
Yes, this is, they've got the economics of it all wrong as well. Anyway, look, something positive to end on is up at Southmead, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think that's, you know, a hopeful development. It contains the notion of making physical health and mental health care stand on equal footing and to boost an input into mental health. Stop the terrible upset and trauma, even though the police, in my experience on the whole, have tried as well as they could to do an extremely difficult job. A police cell is far from ideal, so hopefully in Southmead there will be, it's called a place of safety, but it's a bit like care in the community. you know, a place of safety can't be produced externally, or can be in preventing someone harming themselves. But the individuals who may have to spend time on Section 136 might not feel safe internally in their minds. So the staff interactions and how the staff are with them is much more important than a room. In the end, the place of safety is in good communication with another human being and the installation of help, hope, and the idea that they'd be helped.
Yep. Well, Ray Brown, thanks for sharing your 3 decades in the NHS, your personal recollections from that, and a bit of advice. And I understand you're still practicing, is that right?
That's right, yes. I practice psychotherapy. I have links with to do with various aspects of teaching and training in AWP. I do teaching still in the Avon and Wiltshire Mental Healthcare Trust. And I also write reports for the court in cases of medical negligence. So I'm fully occupied. I'm busier now than before I retire.
Right.
And political work as well.
And I think it's also a good piece of advice to end with is if you know somebody who's having mental health problems, whether or not it's got anything to do with austerity or whatever, do please advise them. Or if it's yourself, go and see your doctor.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much, Ray Brown, for joining
thank
us on
Dialect.
Thank
you very much indeed, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
As you mentioned, my name's Kent Hovind, has been for quite a while. I was a high school science teacher 15 years, and I'll talk about creation, evolution, and dinosaurs. If this is the only session you're getting to see, you've already missed a whole bunch of material. We've talked about in the first couple of sessions, and you can get all my stuff on videotape. We talk about the age of the Earth. You know, the Bible teaches the Earth is only about 6,000 years old. The evolution view says it's billions of years old. Somebody is wrong. And the Bible would indicate that dinosaurs lived with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They were just part of the normal creation. And so for the first 1,600 years of human history, things were very different before the flood came. Things were huge. We cover all that on videotape. And number one, about why the people used to live to be 900 and all this kind of thing and how dinosaurs fit in. And but tonight I want to share with you what the theory of evolution has done for the world. There is no question the kids are being taught evolution in the textbooks. That's without question. But what is it doing for the world? And why? And who's behind all this? Is there a smoke-filled room someplace where we can go, you know, find the people that are in charge of this? I think it's much higher than that. There probably are a lot of smoke-filled rooms and conspiracies, no question, but this is Satan versus God.
Hello, my name's Duncan Bambridge, and over the next few weeks, I'll be taking you through some of the ideas and evidence of US creation scientist Kent Hovind. Kent is currently in jail in the US for alleged tax evasion, and the ideas he talks about are now banned in British free school and academy science lessons. Whether they are wrong or right is not the question. Rather, should children be taught both creation and evolution and be left to make their own mind up?
The problem is people have rejected God's authority. They don't want God to reign over them. It started with Lucifer in the Garden of Eden. Lucifer, Satan, came to Eve in the Garden of Eden, and he said to the woman, "Yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" First thing he said was a question in Genesis chapter 3. The second thing he said was, "Ye shall not surely die," calling God a liar. And the third thing Satan said to Eve, he said, "Ye shall be as gods." Satan started this lie that man can become like God. And it's a lie, and that's really evolution in a nutshell. Ye shall be as gods. That's where the whole idea got started. It started with Satan. It didn't start with Charlie Darwin. It started with the devil. Actually, he's the one who wants to be God. Lucifer wants to be God. Isaiah 14, Lucifer said, "I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars. I will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." See, the devil wants to be God, but the job is not available. So he's all upset about that. And he can't be God. So he's mad at God, but he can't do anything to God, at us, because we are made in God's image. See, that's why the devil hates you. You remind him of God. He hates humanity, period. He wants to destroy the human race. Financially, emotionally, physically, spiritually, every way he can, he wants to destroy everything about what God has made. So you have to look at this from a heavenly perspective before you're going to comprehend what on earth is happening. What?
Did You Pray Today by Lisa Taylor from the 1992 album Secrets of the Heart on Giant Records.
See, evolution is not science, it's a philosophy. It's a way of life. The Bible warned us, a way of looking at life. The Bible warned us in Colossians chapter 2 to beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit. You see, what you believe determines how you behave. Your philosophy is extremely important. And there's only two choices. Either there is a God or there isn't. If there is a God, we better find out who he is and what he wants and do what he says. If there is no God, then how do you decide what's right and wrong? Evolution is a philosophy that allows man to psychologically get rid of God where he can become God. He decides if it's right or wrong. You need to be cautious about your philosophy, because the evolution philosophy, if you really follow it through and think about it, it changes your whole way of looking at the world. You see, if evolution is true, man is just an animal, right? Just a higher animal, that's all we are. And animals would have the same rights that we do. Animal rights activists, huh? That comes from their philosophy of evolution, folks. If evolution is true, only the strongest have a right to survive. The weakest should be eliminated. Don't you pull the weeds out of your garden? If you believe in evolution, maybe these weaker, inferior humans should be eliminated. Ah, I see where that would lead in a few short time. If evolution is true, might makes right. You're the strongest, you got the right to rule the world. King of the jungle. Inferiors should be eliminated. One of the races of humans must be superior to the rest. Isn't that a normal following or corollary to the evolution theory? Oh, yeah. Protection of the world and the environment is our duty, because we have evolved the farthest. We need to save the planet. Flows right from the same philosophy. There are no absolutes about right and wrong. Professors sometimes say that when I do debates at universities, they'll say, there are no absolutes. I say, are you absolutely sure? If there are no absolutes, how can you be so sure? By the way, I tell them, if your brain is nothing but a collection of chemicals that got together by random chance over billions of years, how can you trust your thoughts and your reasoning process? Wow, think about that one. How do we decide what's right and wrong? I spoke at a public school. I get into lots of public schools. I did about 100 last year. I spoke at a public school in Pennsylvania. The auditorium would only hold 300. They had 900 kids, so they brought them in three shifts for me. One of the groups came in. A kid sat on the second row, a senior at the high school. He said, Mr. Hovind, I'm an atheist. I said, really? He said, yep, there is no God. I said, well, let me ask you a question, son. Do you know everything? He said, well, no, of course not. I said, well, do you know half of everything? He said, well, no. I said, okay, well, let's pretend that you know half of everything. Is it possible that God exists in the other half you don't know? Brand new thought. I said, by the way, son, if you're an atheist, let me ask you a question. How do you decide what's right and wrong? He said, oh, that's easy. I decide if it's right or wrong. He said, I'm the God of my own universe. I said, boy, I'm glad to hear that, because I'm going to shoot you in 5 minutes. He said, you can't do that. I said, yeah, I can. I'm the God of my own universe. I decided it's fine.
And there'll be more from creation scientist Kent Hovind next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, cannabis is a drug which for many years has been illegal. But why? Because some people say, in fact, many doctors say that it's actually incredibly helpful, but still illegal. Anyway, I'm joined by two people here now from the Bristol Cannabis Club. It's Joe Moss and Anastair Burrell. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Tony. Thanks for having us in.
Now, first of all, with you, Joe, what is the benefit of cannabis and why join a club?
The benefit of cannabis or the benefits of joining a club?
Okay, one by one.
Okay. The benefits of cannabis, for health-wise, it can help many people. People with cancer, people with multiple sclerosis, people with ME, people with glaucoma, people with cyclical vomiting syndrome, people with eczema, people with asthma. The list pretty much is endless.
So how does it help those people? Cancer, for example, how can cannabis help?
Cannabis is known to kill cancer cells in people with cancer, with different types of cancer. The research is still ongoing, and there's been a lot of anecdotal evidence, and more recently, patents applied for cannabis as treatment in cancer.
Okay, and what about the club? What's the point?
The point of the club is to allow like-minded individuals to get together to discuss activism, to discuss cannabis and educating people, to promote harm reduction within people that do use cannabis, and to create a model for regulation should we get that opportunity in the UK.
Alistair, what's your interest in cannabis?
My interest is recreational, medicinal, and social. So it's all three of the elements, really.
But you started with recreational there, but for a lot of people, they will say, well, actually, cannabis can be quite dangerous psychologically.
I'd counter that to say that it hasn't ever caused me any harm personally. A lot of the people I know who smoke it hasn't caused them any harm. If anything, it seems to assist them.
Well, one of the things even doctors are saying, some of them, is that skunk, the modern type of cannabis, which has been specially kind of genetically grown to be extremely strong, is actually quite dangerous. For some people, it can tip them over the edge.
Yeah, but the studies that they've used have recently been disproven in further studies that the links are purely just casual. I'd accept that there are some risks, obviously, as there are with all drugs. But the idea of legalization is that everybody can be honest and we can put in harm reduction and share the information so that people don't come to harm.
So are you suggesting that people should just be able to go into their local corner shop and buy cannabis just like it's a packet of sweets?
No, it should be fully regulated. That's the problem at the moment. There's no regulation, so minors can quite easily come into contact with a dealer and get hold of cannabis. And once they've got that cannabis, they can then even be moved on to harder things because that dealer often carries other products.
Well, what about this, whether it's a myth or not, maybe you can tell me, that cannabis actually leads to people taking stronger drugs, more dangerous drugs, such as more addictive, such as heroin, for example?
I'd counter that with, I think it's just that it's available from the same source, and I don't think it's anything of a gateway drug. If anything, I'd say alcohol really is the gateway drug. Alcohol's definitely been involved with me and my friends of trying other things.
Joe, the idea of Bristol Cannabis Club, it's almost like, are you people that sort of get together to smoke cannabis?
No, that's not just the point of it. The major point of it is activism.
And what sort of activism are you doing then?
Well, at the moment, our plans at the moment is to join as many people together as possible to link people up, and we're actually planning a large march in Bristol in May next year.
Okay, and ultimately, are you the same as Alistair? You want some sort of legalisation and regulation?
Yes, I'd love to see a regulated system whereby anybody who wishes to use it for recreational or for medicinal purposes can actually go somewhere to buy the cannabis they need that's been produced carefully and with quality control, and that people who... You know, and that the education is there for the people that need it.
For you, do you actually use cannabis?
Yes, I do.
And is that illegal?
Yes, it's completely illegal.
And it seems maybe that things have moved on beyond the law, because even talking to police, sometimes they say, well, a little bit of recreational use of cannabis or medicinal use of it, we would rather actually focus our attention on more serious crimes.
Yes, and that's what they say to us too.
Alistair, what about you?
In what regard, sorry?
Well, the police's attitude to, you know, you're committing a crime by smoking cannabis, whether it's medicinal or recreational. So what's the police's attitude?
It does tend to vary, and sadly, it can often tend to vary based upon how people might look or might seem. So I see some people are targeted for it, whereas others, perhaps a blind eye is being turned. So at the moment, it's a bit of a lottery, really, and that's definitely something we need to change.
What about the sort of long-term effects of, I mean, a lot of people who don't have anything to do with cannabis would see people who smoke cannabis as kind of almost like wasters, people who are kind of just sitting around dreaming, they're not actually getting engaged with society.
Well, they'd have to see that we do come from all backgrounds of life. We have lots of varied careers. Some of us scientists, some of us technologists, some of us work in medical sectors.
Give us an idea of some of the people who are part of the Bristol Cannabis Club, just a sort of spectrum of different types of people.
Care managers, bouncers, fit personal trainers. I'm just trying to think who else. There's a lot of people who work as carers and those kinds of people, you know, people who do healthcare jobs, medical jobs. I used to be a care home manager before illness struck me, and just and there's not a defining thing. There's not a type of person who smokes cannabis. Every, you know, people from all walks of life. I've known solicitors, judges, everybody.
Really? Even yes. judges?
Crikey. Even judges.
Joe, how does it help you then in how your conditions?
I have a fairly rare syndrome called complex regional pain syndrome, which is where my immune system attacks any injury on my body, and it's extremely painful. The pain is off the scale. I was taking lots of medication. You can't.
So is that what you're saying, that you kind of get a bruise and then your own immune system attacks the bruise?
It, yeah, oh, bruises gosh. Or nerve damage is the worst. Where I've got nerve damage in my body, the pain is excruciating. I was taking lots of prescribed medication. My kidney and liver functions were failing, and my own GP, who actually suggested to me that I tried different types of cannabis to help manage my symptoms, and I've taken myself out of a wheelchair and actually gained my life back.
So your GP is telling you to do something illegal?
Yes.
Well, not telling you, advising you.
Advising me to help, try and help myself, which is what I did.
Okay. Also, whereabouts are we going with this? Do you think there's any kind of real interest in the present coalition government or in Europe or future governments in changing the law?
I mean, Norman Baker called last week for the liberalisation of cannabis laws in the UK to help people such as myself who are denied Sativex on prescription to be able to actually help themselves with cannabis.
Why is it illegal, Alistair?
It's a very good question. It goes back so far.
I think it wasn't it the end of, or the middle of the 1900s, or yeah, between World War One and World War Two.
World War II is the single convention on narcotic drugs.
Around the same time as prohibition in the United States. Exactly. Was there any relation between cannabis being prohibited and alcohol?
Harry Aslinger was the one who tacked, because the League of Nations was coming up with the Dangerous Drugs Act, and Harry Aslinger tagged it on to the dangerous drugs, which I think then were heroin and cocaine. Cannabis was tagged on along with the other drugs.
So there's a sort of politics to this from a long time ago. Obviously, up until the time between World War One and World War Two, it was a perfectly legal thing to do. It's also a cultural thing, Alistair, isn't it, with a lot of Afro-Caribbeans?
Yeah, I've read quite a few articles on that about during the Nixon administration, how he was hoping to use it possibly as a tool so that he could gel Afro-Caribbeans. It's unfortunate.
So it's a kind of, the idea is a lot of Afro-Caribbeans do this, so let's make it illegal.
Yeah. Yes.
And actually, it's funny, isn't it? But Britain does seem to sort of hang on the coattails of the United States all the time, even to this day. I mean, we're doing things like changing the law to allow American crime commissioners to come over here and become our police chiefs, from superintendents upwards as well. I mean, we seem to try and copy everything, like at the private healthcare system, getting rid of the NHS as well from America. So I guess what you're doing here is you're saying in a way you'd rather that Britain reversed its policy of following the US. But ultimately, how are you going to make sure this is regulated?
I think really that the easiest way for us to do that is to look at what's happening already in Colorado and Washington, and to use those guys who are kind of laying out a template for us, and to get on that and then to start improving that.
Okay. And so how can listeners get in touch with Bristol Cannabis Club?
You can contact us via our Facebook page, which is simply Bristol Cannabis Club, or you can contact us at our email address, which is bristolcannabisclub@gmail.com.
So it's only on the internet, but do you actually meet regularly?
Yes, we do.
So can people actually come and find you if they're not online?
Our next meeting is at the Chelsea in Easton on the 5th of September at 8 p.m.
And do you meet regularly? Is it sort of the first something of every month or something?
It's usually around the first weekend of every month, and sometimes in between whiles. but no, it's regularly. But in October, we're actually planning a trip to London for a march that's taking place there.
Okay, just remind us again of the Facebook page and email address.
Okay, the Facebook page is Bristol Cannabis Club, and the email address is bristolcannabisclub@gmail.com.
Okay, so Joe Moss and Alistair Burrell from Bristol Cannabis Club, and also another bigger nationwide organisation called Normal UK. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly podcast, and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, psychiatrist Roy Brown, also to Joe Moss and Alistair Burrell from Bristol Cannabis Club. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. That.